This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about renewable energy and a carbon-free, nuclear-free economy. And with me to talk about this is Arjun Makhijani. Makhijani is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, and he did the first study ever on the potential of energy conservation in the U.S. That was way back in 1971. He's the author most recently of Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. Arjun Makhijani, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Matt.
1971, how'd you get on this so early?
Well, when I went to do my doctorate at Berkeley in 1970, there was an energy seminar. It was an advanced energy seminar, sort of before its time. You expect that of Berkeley. And a nuclear engineering professor came and gave a talk about nuclear power, and he was honest about the radiation and pollution problems involved, as in uranium mining and milling. I just come from industry. I had helped design two uranium mills, and I was kind of shocked that we had no radiation protections for the environment when we designed these uranium mills. This was the 60s, before all the environmental laws.
Or for the workers, for that matter.
Or for the workers. Yeah. And, some workers may have had film badges and so on, but really, yeah, there were no alarms. I was an electrical engineer wiring up everything that needed to be wired up on paper. And then he said, you know, coal is much worse. And he went through that. And he said, we should build 1,000 nuclear power plants by the year 2000. That was the sort of magic number in those days. And I stuck my hand up and said, why 1,000? And nobody had an answer. They were all the best and the brightest in the room there at Berkeley. And I was furious at myself for shutting my mind off when I went to work. And I don't know that I actually swore never to do it again, but I was furious enough that I think I've stayed awake on the job ever since.
Did he give you an answer as to why 1,000,
no,
or did he just
no
pull
No one
out
had
there?
An answer. They said it's economic growth, and my response was it's not an engineering answer. Why can't we have the same economic growth with less energy, or why doesn't it take more? Why is it energy growth equal to economic growth? It's not. There's no magic in engineering. So since I wanted to do my doctorate in that, but this was before the energy crisis, so nobody wanted to finance a research assistantship in energy in 1970. So I was so upset with myself that I determined to answer the question anyway, and so that's how I wound up doing the study.
And why have we not made more progress on energy since 1971? Earth Day was 1970, and yet here we are, 2009.
We've actually made more progress than people realize. Before 1973, as I was saying, energy growth and economic growth were supposed to go hand in hand. During that energy crisis, I worked for S. David Freeman in Washington in the Ford Foundation Energy Policy Project. And we set forth technical scenarios and methods and policies to reduce energy growth while maintaining economic growth. And our report, A Time to Choose America's Energy Future, became Carter's energy policy because S. David Freeman worked for Carter. And CAFE standards came from there. The public utilities law came from there. Of course, California was the leader in appliance standards. So a lot of things came. And if you look at what has happened since 1973, well, from 73 to 85, we had zero energy growth with positive economic growth. We now have energy growth that is more or less per capita constant, and leaving aside economic crises like we're going through now. I think we're still pretty inefficient, and we can actually reduce the amount of energy we're using and have economic growth unaffected.
I'm speaking with Arjun Makajani. He's the author of Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. He's the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. This is Progressive Radio, and I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive. You set out in this book the contention, which you argue vigorously, that we can be carbon free and nuclear free by 2040 or 2050. How do we get there? Why are you so sure we can get there by then?
Well, you know, when I started writing this book, I wasn't sure at all. I'm an engineer, and I don't like to recommend things that'll result in unreliable or costly energy systems. The first given of an electricity system is the light should come on when you flip the switch. And the second given is your bill should be reasonable. And those two things are connected, because if you can't pay your bill, the supplier can't buy the fuel, and then things will break down. But in the last 5-7 years, there has been a revolution in energy technology that is going on. It's not complete. Some things are sort of more in the beginning stages. Other things are in the middle stages. Other parts of this revolution have already happened. So, for instance, wind energy is now economical. It's more economical, it's cheaper than nuclear, than new nuclear. So as evidence, we built 8,000 megawatts of wind turbines last year in the United States and zero nuclear, even though they have very similar subsidies from the federal government. Wall Street will finance wind. They will not finance nuclear.
You have a figure in this book that is astonishing. You say 6 states, that is the Dakotas, Kansas, Nebraska, Montana, and Texas, have the potential to produce more energy than all 104 nuclear power plants combined.
Wind energy alone, yeah. Yes. That's leaving aside the great solar energy potential of Texas, for example. 100 by 100 mile square in the United States Southwest can supply all of the electricity that we generate from solar energy. So, and we have the technology. Solar thermal power has a free thermonuclear reactor 93 million miles away. We call it the sun. And all we need to do is harvest it. Now, we're very fortunate in this country to have immense reservoirs of renewable energy. And I think not only renewable energy, but efficiency has to be the foundation. We have not had the policies to put efficiency into place. May I give you an example?
Sure.
The average energy consumption in a home is 58,000 BTU per square foot per day. You don't need to remember the exact number. If you look at Hanover House, which is a house in New Hampshire, you can go to Google and see a picture of it and so on. It didn't cost really an extravagant amount to build, just $110 or $11 a square foot. And this is a reasonable cost for building a new house. Its energy footprint is only 15%, 15% of an average house. Why? It was built with common sense, south-facing windows, good insulation, all that. And it has a large solar water heater, and you can do this in most places in the country very well. 1,000-gallon tank, they supply most of their space heating and water heating from that and consume very little energy. Now, why are we not doing this? The reason we're not doing this is developers who build houses have no interest in supplying you with an efficient house. People don't fall in love with efficiency when they buy a new house. They fall in love with azaleas and granite counters and the view and the light and the wood floors and the jacuzzis or whatever. And, you know, this is true of all of us. We fell in love with the light and the wood floors and bought the house and worried about the bills later. Now we keep the house pretty cool in the winter. But it's called the split incentive.
Right.
The consumer pays the bill but doesn't control what went into the house. Now, we need regulations for developers to say, so many BTU per square foot and more. Now, there is a bill in Washington which would require a steady improvement in efficiency of new houses, 70% by 2028, and in commercial buildings, 70% by 2029. That's what we need. We need that at the state level, local level, by climate, of course.
And, of course, the government has more power over the buildings that it owns or is going to build than it has in the private sector.
Yeah, one of the things, you know, I if you put yourself in a Gandhian mode, you know, be the change that you want to see in the world, then if the government is going to impose this on the private sector, it should put its own house in order. So I advocate really that the government should be efficient and fully renewable and have only electric cars over the next 15, 20 years. And by doing that, it will stimulate the market for all of these things enough that they will become economical and affordable for everybody else. I'm not much for subsidies into the energy sector. I think the way we should use public money is to put federal, state, and local government buildings and vehicular sector in order.
Yeah, this was an idea that Ralph Nader had decades ago when I was working for him, have the government buy the most fuel-efficient cars possible, et cetera. And now, you know, the idea of using solar panels on every government building, for instance, would go a long way. I know Bernie Sanders had a bill about that.
Yes.
But I don't think it's become law. I know Obama's had some initiatives to get some solar into some government buildings.
Yeah, there are some initiatives in the stimulus bill and in the energy appropriations, but I think they don't go out very far and they're not ambitious enough. One of the slogans that came out of my book is parking lots are the answer. We have so many parking lots and commercial rooftops that urban surfaces, you know, shading the highways with solar photovoltaics in urban areas, the freeways, the beltways, and so on. If you use these surfaces, you can do it on a large enough scale, yet you don't need new transmission lines that bother people. You don't need to cross national parks with transmission lines. You can generate most of the electricity from solar photovoltaics in urban surfaces. And I think we really should give this a high priority and
so
get it done.
So by parking lots, you mean covered parking lots?
Yes. So,
and you put the panels on top.
Yeah, so you can download my book free at carbonfreenuclearfree.org, www.carbonfreenuclearfree.org. And there you'll see in that book a picture of a U.S. Navy parking lot with 750 kilowatts. It was actually done in 2002. Now, just that one partially shaded parking lot. So you get to park your car in the shade. It doesn't get that hot when you get into it in the summer. Just that one installation could power 250 houses if they are as efficient as the Hanover house.
But I keep hearing when I talk to a utility person, for instance, that solar's inefficient. We're not there yet. We can't. Wind is inefficient. You know, you can't get the scales that you need. The infrastructure's not there. We're decades and decades away.
Well, this is really wrong. Wind industry is now really a mature industry. I mean, utilities will say we should build nuclear. Nuclear is actually a moribund industry. We don't even have the infrastructure to build new nuclear power plants on any significant scale in this country. But we do have the infrastructure for wind. Last year, we installed 8,000 megawatts. This is huge. This is $15 to $20 billion of investment in the wind industry just in the United States, and about $50 to $60 billion of investment in wind turbines worldwide. You're not talking backyard technology. I'm not denigrating backyard technology, but the scale on which wind is happening is immense. Denmark gets 20% of its electricity from wind. It is intermittent. You do need to back it up. We have the storage technologies to solve this problem. We have the standby and reserve capacity to solve this problem of intermittency. And I am confident. I came here to Wisconsin to present to the Wisconsin Public Utilities Institute about base load wind, 24/7, 365 days a year. And I put it to them, many advocates of nuclear power, that this will be cheaper and more reliable, and we can do this now. We don't have to wait for government loan guarantees to build nuclear power plants.
Well, let's talk, Arjun Makhachani, a little bit more about nuclear. This is a field that you've obviously you encountered back in 1970 when
yes.
The person said we should have 1,000 more nuclear power plants. What is your critique of nuclear power? Why is it not part of the answer?
Well, at the most fundamental level, if you leave the proliferation and waste questions and so on, if you just look at it as a technical economic issue for the electricity sector and consider the requirements of what we need to do for climate change and to get rid of coal and CO2 emissions. I tell people we don't have a shortage of low carbon dioxide emitting energy sources. We have a shortage of two other things, time and money. And on both those things, nuclear falls painfully short. So it takes 10 years to build a nuclear power plant, 8 years at best. You have to forecast electricity 8 years ahead. In times of economic crisis, you don't know if there's going to be a structural change. Last time there was a structural change in electricity use in the 70s and early 80s, and more than 100 nuclear power plants were canceled. Ratepayers, bondholders lost a lot of money. It takes so long to build nuclear power that if you compared building wind and solar with building nuclear, it would cost us, in my estimate, around $100 billion extra in carbon dioxide costs if we decided to go nuclear compared to wind and solar. So it takes too long. The other thing is nuclear now has had government subsidies and insurance and so on of one kind or another for 50 years. It's supposed to be a mature industry. It should stand on its own. But the people who say there'll be a nuclear renaissance and will deliver you from the perils of climate change, they really don't want to do it on their own. They know it's not economical. I'll give you an example. Progress Energy in Florida wants to build two nuclear power plants. The Florida Public Utilities Commission has given them advance money from ratepayers at zero interest. So you're paying more in your electricity bill so Progress Energy can build a $17 billion power plant. Is this the only way they can do it? Because Wall Street will not finance those power plants because the cost of those power plants is more than the market capitalization of Progress Energy as a whole.
Aren't the ratepayers up in arms down in Florida?
They are up in arms, and that's because they've been treated like suckers by the Florida legislature and the Public Utilities Commission. The deal for the ratepayers is they give money to the utilities to build these power plants, but the utility does not promise to complete the power plants or deliver any electricity. It's like asking a builder to build you a house, and the builder says, yeah, give me the money, but I don't promise to finish it or ever give you the keys. That's the deal.
So I thought that people would be upset by that.
Yeah, and they are upset by that.
You said at the beginning of this discussion on nuclear power, Arjun Makhijani, that you wanted to put to one side, at least for the moment, this question of proliferation and waste. Why don't we talk about that, though, because that's part and parcel of the nuclear problem.
Yes. You know, fortunately, we have a president who realizes that we don't live in planet America. We live on planet Earth. And that has two very important things. There's a sort of environmental thing and a political thing. The environmental thing is you got to solve the problem of CO2 and nuclear proliferation as part of planet Earth. You cannot solve it as part of planet America. The United States doesn't determine everything. We're seeing that with the prickly problems of North Korea and Iran and so on. He also recognizes politically that we live on planet Earth. You know, it's a complicated place, and the United States is one very important player, big player, the biggest economy in the world, most powerful country. But we see the limitations of this quote-unquote most powerful country every day. Can't tell people what to do successfully. Much as you would like to, it can't be done. So I think the best way to control proliferation is to make an announcement. We are not going to use nuclear power. We know we have more nuclear power plants than anybody today. It's just like nuclear weapons. We've got more nuclear weapons between here and Russia. But we're going to phase them out. We're going to get rid of them. We're going to do nuclear disarmament, and we'll get rid of nuclear power. Why do I say nuclear power is important in proliferation? Because there is an 80%, you know, a very large overlap between the technical, the human infrastructure, what you need to know, the physics, the engineering of building and operating reactors and fuel fabrication, and building a bomb. Much of what's different you can actually probably find on the internet.
One source of energy that we haven't talked about yet, Arjun Makhijani, is this question of biofuels or ethanol.
Yeah.
What's your take on ethanol, for instance?
Well, the way we're doing it is wrong. I think turning fuel into food and food into fuel doesn't make common sense, and it makes even less sense from the point of view of physics or economics. We should not. I know that, you know, a lot of ordinary farmers are caught up in this. A lot of people have invested, cooperatives have built these plants, but we need to work our way out of this as rapidly as possible. I think there is a place for biomass fuels, but we should not be using agricultural land, and we should not be using food, especially as fuels. Wastes, yes. You know, if somebody's throwing away French fry oil, you can make it in biodiesel. But that's not going to solve our main problem. My other slogan from my book is weeds are the answer, in the plural. Weeds are the answer.
And what do you mean by that?
What do I mean by that is aquatic weeds, like water hyacinths, like cattails, like microalgae, will grow in wastewater. In fact, you can use them to help you clean up wastewater. So you don't need agricultural land. You could send the wastewater from Los Angeles back up into the Owens Valley and clean up the water and preserve water in the Owens Valley and send the clean water back and grow aquatic weeds. Weeds are a nuisance in the garden because they grow very fast. But from an energy point of view, they're a blessing because they are very efficient capturers of solar energy and whatever nutrients happen to be around. You can grow a lot of these in brackish water, so you don't even need fresh water or irrigation to do this. Productivity very high. My other answer for that is we really should move to electric transportation as much as possible. I'm very glad that President Obama has talked about intercity trains, but really need to get it done. We also need to move to electric vehicles. The other energy problem, of course, is the war for oil problem. And in the progressive, you know this very well. I mean, you've been in the leadership in promoting, ideas of peace and against war. But we have to stop this war for oil. And the only way it can be done is to get rid of oil, not just oil imports, but I think we should get rid of oil. Too much urban pollution, And one of the reasons I felt we can go to renewable energy at moderate cost is I think the revolution in transportation technology is here, aircraft aside. We already have all electric cars being marketed. They're at the high-end sports cars. But if you look at the high-end sports car that's today being marketed successfully, it's called the Tesla. It sells for $109,000. But if you look at its performance, it compares to a Lamborghini that costs $250,000. So if you are in that market, the electric car is already more economical. Now, in the next few years, there's already manufacturing in the pipeline to bring electric cars to the ordinary consumer marketplace. By ordinary consumer, I mean those who are in the market for a new car.
So this is all electric, not the hybrid, not the Prius?
Yes, I think not the Prius. I think plug-in hybrids may be a transition technology, but my sense of the current development is all electric cars are actually making much more rapid progress than what I thought would happen when I wrote the book, which is 2 years ago. I think Nissan and Renault are going to market an all-electric car next year. The state of Israel has decided they're going to do all-electric cars in partnership with Nissan and Renault, and they're going to do it on a very interesting model. They're going to make cars like cell phones. You won't own the car. You'll just own the miles. So you'll go into a gas station. They'll take out the battery. They'll put a new bank of already charged batteries, and off you go. So it's very interesting new technology and finance ideas are coming into the marketplace now.
Arjun Makhijani mentioned his book. The book's title is Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. What can individuals do in the here and now to reduce our carbon footprint?
Well, a couple of things. The big problem is structural. You know, it's beyond individuals. Residential energy consumption is about a third of energy consumption. So even if you take care of everything, you'll still we have a still big indirect footprint. You can become a vegetarian. I'm not a vegetarian, so I should. I mostly eat vegetarian. They reduce your carbon footprint a great deal. You can insulate your house. You can, you know, seal the ducts and seal the windows and wrap the ducts and water heaters and so on. But apart from that, we've got a carbon-free, nuclear-free alliance. Go to our website, join the alliance. I think a lot of the solution will come from the state and local level. We've got 750 mayors who are signed up to renewable energy. We've got states in the leadership, Republican-led and Democrat-led states. You have a very good governor's report right here in Wisconsin. You have a nuclear moratorium in place. I would work to keep those moratoria in place and at the state level set a goal for 100% renewable electricity sectors. We're working in a number of states. I think the states will push the federal government.
How do you combat the vested interests both at the state legislative level and also on Capitol Hill?
I think the state level is more accessible to those who have fewer resources. There's less resources in terms of what's in the electoral system at the state level. Washington is just swarming with lobbyists. It's very difficult. And so if you look at the reality as it's evolving on the ground, you see everybody wants their subsidies and their 2 bits, and they don't care whether somebody else is getting, 10 bits. They want their 2 bits of subsidies, and they all coalesce around special interest politics, really, in not a very good way. And so it's very, very difficult to fight those vested interests. Less difficult today. I have to say that one thing has been accomplished by the election of President Obama, and that has translated from his election campaign into political Washington, is now it is accepted we need to reduce CO2 emissions by 80% or more if we're going to solve the problem of climate change. I think this is a dramatic change. To reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% or more, we're going to have to reduce electricity emissions by 90% or more.
Yeah, you say it's acutely necessary that we get carbon-free and nuclear-free by 2050. We only have about a minute and a half left, but if you could just explain why that is so urgent.
Well, we can't go the nuclear route. We'll have to build a reactor a week worldwide. We've got problems with enrichment, one enrichment plant in Iran that could be used for reactor fuel or for bombs. Imagine having to build 2 enrichment plants a year and policing that world. It's not very sensible. So the nuclear-free, and no one knows what to do with the waste. Even the French don't know what to do with the waste. You can go and watch my debate with Patrick Moore or my testimony in Minnesota and get a real read on the problems the French are having with nuclear waste. The carbon-free piece of it is really easy. We've got a very serious problem with climate. The Arctic melting is happening much faster than predicted, now projected possibly within 10 years, whereas a few years ago it was thought to be a several hundred-year problem. So we've got to get rid of this. We can do it. We have the technology, and I'm saying, why not?
That's the question to ask. Arjun Makhijani, thanks so much for being my guest today. Arjun Makhijani is the author, most recently, of Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, A Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. You can go to www.carbonfreenuclearfree.org or IEER.org.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.